committee to order at this time. All members are present, if we count Senator Ellis outside in the hallway.
He's coming. He's coming.
Yeah.
Glad to have you. So all HESC members are present. So we have Senator Morris, Senator Johnny Ellis here, Senator Eaton over there, and Senator Brett Dyson over there on the end. And we do have three reports that's going to present us today. The first one is going to come from a health workforce plan that's presented by Alaska Mental Health Trust. Who's presenting? I don't see the names on here.
Senator, there's going to be a group of us. I'll be happy to start. I'm Jim Lynch from Fairbanks. There'll be three of us sharing the information.
So do all three want to come up at the same time? Or one, you may come have a seat here.
It's a 90-day session. We got to hurry.
Yeah. So you're going to tell us about the workforce plan, right? And you're going to give your names for the record. And
who you're representing, so we'll have it on. Yes, Senator. I was also asked, Colette, I'm not sure how to turn on the projector today. Senator, my name is Jim Lynch, L-Y-M-C-H, from Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm the Chief Finance Officer for Fairbanks Memorial Hospital.
Delisa Culpepper, Chief Operating Officer for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
And Jan Harris, Vice Provost for Health Programs at UAA.
We're ready to begin at your request, Senator.
When are you ready?
Okay. I'm waiting for the projector to connect with the laptop. I'm going to go ahead and begin the information for you. Said, my name is Jim Lynch. I'm here representing the healthcare industry, the delivery part of the industry. The information that you have in front of you is pertaining to the Healthcare Workforce Coalition. This is not a separate 501c3. This is not a separate legal entity. This is a true volunteer coalition of different aspects of the health industry, both public and private, that have come together to work on a strategic plan for the whole state of Alaska for health workforce. We've been at this effort for about 18 months. Our plan has been endorsed by numerous groups, including the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. And for purposes of disclosure to the committee, I am the current chair of the board, but I'm presenting to you today from purpose of my day job in healthcare operations. And so I don't know if my colleagues have any other opening comments. I'm still seeing that the technology.
Mr. Lynch, are you waiting for that to happen? Do you have in here a list of the members of the coalition?
I'm going
to
ask.
Do we have that information? If we don't, we'd like to have it.
Yes.
Yes, Senator. It is embodied in the spiral plan document itself.
Okay.
And all that list is evolving all the time. We have, the partnerships include clinics, hospitals, physicians, the Department of Labor, Department of Health, Department of Education. A number of our colleagues are here today, and so on. So it's a very diverse list, organized labor, Department of Apprenticeship for the federal DOL, several diverse partners of that nature. I still see that technology is working, but I want to make the best of your time, so we're going to go ahead and introduce some of the material. I'm told that you have a hard copy in your packets of the PowerPoint.
Are you working from this document?
Working from
the
PowerPoint. Yes. For my part, I'm going to speak to the industry part of and many of these statistics as the HESC committee you're already aware of, so please feel free to redirect me at any time. But we all understand that healthcare industry is a big part of the economy, a significant employer as well. Healthcare represents approximately 10% of the total workforce in Alaska, payroll of more than $1.4 billion a year, et cetera. It's a very labor-intensive industry and is not likely to be workforce is not likely to be reduced by the application of technology, but actually increased by the application of technology that requires more people to operate it. So I think this group is very familiar with the impact that healthcare has on the labor market. We go forward, and I'm going through the slides quickly. I'm looking at a slide titled Where Alaska Healthcare Services Jobs Are from 2009. You can see the pie chart there, centers that shows that 41% are in hospitals, another 33% in doctor's offices, and then divided between the smaller elements of the pie from there. If we look at the next page, and this information, by the way, it is footnoted, but it generally comes from the Department of Labor Research and Analysis Division. So this is available to you in more detail from them. We're all aware that healthcare, both in the last decade and the predictions for the coming decade, are significant growth. Healthcare jobs dominate the list of top growth jobs for the state. On the next slide, you see the continued growth is expected, the blue vertical bar graph, and that shows that forecast. This trend is, of course, driven by two factors. The largest one is the aging population. In healthcare, this has a dual impact. Not only are we going to have workers that retire, but at the same time, our aging population is going to be demanding significantly more health service. So we have the conflicting supply and demand elements of labor going on, and this is going to exacerbate the problem for us. This is not unique to Alaska, but I think Alaska and other rural states need to be very aggressive in how they address this problem, because we don't have the population to draw from. So we're going to have to work very hard to create the physicians, nurses, pharmacists, therapists, etc. for the future. Again, I'm going quickly through the slides to make best use of your time. I have a slide in here on healthcare as a complex industry, where we've borrowed a slide from the federal battle over health reform just for the graphic presentation. Everybody in this room understands the complexity. One of the challenges in training the workforce, though, is an example of that complexity, are all the individual licensure rules. Virtually every profession that requires an educational background in health has its own licensure body with its own licensure credentials. That is a factor that we have to work within as we build training models to get Alaskans into these careers. So it is one of the challenges that we're working with. I think, again, this group is all aware of the shortages, but I want to point out the connection to economics again. In my own facility alone, we are spending, even as we work to minimize this problem, we're probably spending on average $3 million a year on what we refer to as contract labor. These are mainly non-resident temporary employees brought in on short-term assignments to fill critical openings until we're able to make a permanent recruit on our own. And that's one facility across the state. The Department of Labor numbers suggest the last number I have statewide to quote to you is a 2005 number quoted at $25 million. And I think that is enormously understated in that particular study. So significant impact, something the committee can certainly request more information on. And as I look ahead, looking at the slide, this critical shortage and distribution issues is just a reminder of the diverse careers that we're talking about. Within the study, which you can look at in more detail, I believe it's probably page approximately 21, there is a sheet on the left-hand side that shows a list of about 150 occupations that we've tracked in the health industries. And that ranges from, you know, housekeepers to physicians. Most all of these careers are going to be in demand, but obviously each of the demand curves is very different. When Jan Harris talks a little bit more about the details of the plan, she'll explain the prioritization process, but we've selected a most urgent group that we're actively working on now. And our purpose for sharing with you today is really informative. We would like this committee and your colleagues to be aware that this plan exists, the purpose of the plan, And be aware that we're a resource to help you if any issues come your way, because this is something that we developed a very extensive partnership. It's industry driven. We've pulled what we believe are hopefully all the correct partners together, and we hope to make a real difference on this effort for these careers. The slide, let me see if I was one ahead of myself. The next slide, top 10 positions for vacancies and vacancy rates, is an example of the type of data that we've collected that Jan can articulate further. The university, in addition to the DOL data, the university pulls together the most robust vacancy study in the state on our behalf to look at the health vacancies statewide. So the other thing to keep in mind when you study the numbers of this issue in the future is that in Alaska, not only are the percentage of vacancies significant, for example, we all understand the registered nurses as example, the largest numeric career in healthcare. And when we look at a vacancy rate that may be, and I'm unfamiliar with today's standard, but let's say it's 12% statewide, that's a significant number. But the actual number is also significant. And my point there is you may come to a small community in Alaska that only needs one pharmacist, but without that single pharmacist, they can't operate a pharmacy. So we have to look very judiciously at the numbers case by case in Alaskan communities because they can have a very significant impact. The slide 12 talks about activity across the continuum, and really what this does is outline for you our four broad strategic categories. Through your other assignments, you may have encountered in recent years other workforce plans. There is a gas line plan that the Commissioner of Labor talks about often. There is a petroleum process industries consortium workforce plan out there in the world. This is another example of a similar tool, the workforce plan for health. The one point I want to make in these four strategic planks of engagement, train, recruit, and retain is the recruit part. Most plans from the workforce development arena are talking purely about the training part of development, K through 12 education, post-secondary, and employment. In our plan, we're looking at a health system to maintain the population of the people of the state of Alaska. We recognize that recruitment from the outside to Alaska will be an equal part of our puzzle, along with developing Alaskans to fill these careers. Neither one will get the job done in isolation, and we know that we're going to have to pursue both strategies. So that is one point I'd like to make to any audience on this plan. That concludes my portion. I tried to go quickly. I apologize. I wish we would have had the benefit of the technology with us.
You did go quickly, we appreciate that, but the slides are not numbered. I said for another group, you might want to make sure that they're numbered so that we can easily get to them.
Thank you, Senator.
But she's going to go through the plan itself, right?
Yes, we have a three.
I just want to give my members an opportunity if they have a question to ask of you. You did go quite fast. If they didn't quite understand something, they might want you to go over.
Absolutely, and Senator, I might offer at your discretion, I will not leave. I will let the presentation continue, and I will gladly stand by for any questions that you may have.
Yes, Senator Dyson?
Thank you. I realize that many of the medical professionals you work for are not in private practice and kind of an institutional setting which protects them from many of the liability issues. Is that the nod means yes?
Yes, sir.
All right. Only my wife has to call me sir, not you. Betty's laughing because she knows my wife. Give that, please.
Through the chair, yes, Senator.
In Texas, they've passed some tort reform, particularly trying to deal with the high insurance, liability insurance for doctors and some other professionals. And they claim they have the happy results of doctors moving from several neighboring states and lawyers moving out. And no offense, please, but is there anything more that we need to do on liability to make this to be a more attractive place for medical practitioners to work?
Through the chair, Senator, it's an excellent question. I'm not an expert in the area, but I can offer my informed opinion. So, yes, I believe there's always more to do. You're probably aware or perhaps involved. The state of Alaska has made some positive steps forward in the last 5 or 6 years. We put some limitations on, at least on frivolous lawsuits, and so that was a definite step forward that helps control some of the greatest risk to physicians, and certainly appreciated. I believe there are more that can be done, but I would rather bring an expert testimony at some point for you. But I will make a suggestion related to that. There are other policy issues that can be influenced, and we do cover that within the body of this plan. Within this public-private partnership, we've developed a pretty good think tank. I'm a spokesperson. I want to speak to the economic impact of what we're talking about, but some of our colleagues are very knowledgeable on the policy side. There are policies from related to recruitment. We talk about financial aid packages that the state could weigh in on to attract physicians and other providers to the state. There are practice environment policies that can be looked at, that DHSS policy that may make it favorable or unfavorable for Alaska compared to other states as a practice environment. Absolutely things that we should consider.
Yeah, and the chair can speak for herself, but my sense is that this committee wants to do the best we can, and if you can help us figure out what that is, you know, most of these folks are caring and problem solvers. You can equip us. We would appreciate it.
Through the chair, thank you, and yes, Senator, that's absolutely the mission. For today, we're not here making an ask. So today, we're here sharing, excuse me. I stand respectfully corrected. Long term, we will want to talk about these policy issues, and right now we're still in the vetting stage of that in the planning. Thank you, Senator.
It does look like our technology is not going to work, so because we don't have page numbers, I can see what page they're on. I will hand them up like Vanna, so you can see when they, great. So you'll know what slide she's talking great. Off of.
That helps.
Okay.
All righty. I'll go ahead and focus us a little bit on the plan itself and on the process that we use to get to it.
Like this one, guys.
Yeah, that's the one. There have been many dedicated people that have worked over the years to expand and improve the health workforce in the state. And those people are found in all sectors, in education, in government, and industry. And what this process has done and what Jim described was people who knew each other were working on things sort of got together about a year and a half ago and started the core of this coalition and started working on this plan. The next slide talks about the plan development process. The group got together in the summer of 2009 and spent a number of months then talking with stakeholders, especially in health forums of all sorts that occurred during the course of the year, and also did surveys of groups that did not have available forums to access. So during the fall and winter of 2009-10, that process went on, and the plan was crafted then as a result of that. Priorities were identified during that process that I'll mention in a little bit. In May of last year, the plan was presented to the Workforce Investment Board and approved. And since that time, we've really been doing a second year of planning to get from these major strategies that were identified into action plans that can be implemented. So the following page, it's the schematic of the general workforce strategies that were identified that were pertinent to health. These are the types of strategies that you might find in any industry, just tailored for ours. And as Jim mentioned, we were focused on engage, train, recruit, and retain. We've also been looking at the sustainability of this process because we are a loose coalition. We do a lot of work together on our, in our day jobs and then come together for this planning process. But how do we maintain the energy and maintain the attention going forward? So we have a fifth column for sustaining the process. On the next page, you'll see the initial priority occupations that through that discussion with many, many people, we identified as those that need immediate attention. And Jim mentioned it's actually on page 23 of the plan itself, a compilation of many more health occupations and professions. We chose through the planning process these 15 categories. They represent about 30 occupations and professions that are of most need. And these are the ones that we're focused on this year. There are others in the top tier on page 23 of the plan that we have not included in this first round, but we will also be working on those and doing the initial strategies for those during the course of the year. On page 43 of the plan is an almost impossible to read spreadsheet that compiled data from a number of sources about occupations in the state. And we used that during the planning process as background information to make sure that we, as Jim was mentioning, considered both the numbers of people needed, the percentages of vacancy, the critical nature of various professions and occupations to the ongoing health care for Alaskans. And I will shift to Delisa for the next one.
Okay. As we got through all of the planning, we came up with this little schematic that tells us where some of the things we need to be going. And I think a lot of the important things are over here. Kind of have a shared vision. A lot of us, as Jan said, had been working together in partnership, University of the Trust, DHSS on workforce issues, but we realized there are a lot of other people, the industry is very concerned, and others, and workforce, labor and workforce development, that we all needed to have a more coordinated, broader plan, and so we did this. Now we need to go forward and say, you know, how are we going to get there? And this phase they're working in now to really try and pick some priority plans that get to strategies. Actually, what are we going to do? Some of us in some of our other efforts have gotten to some of the strategies, and we're going to talk about that in a second, that are folded into this plan now. But our vision is to continue to work together. We're not sure exactly in what format yet with the coalition and whether it needs to go to its own 501c3, though it's, some of us are not sure about forming more 501c3s, but we know we need to keep working. We just have to hash out how that's going to happen in a coordinated fashion, whether we'll have one of our other agencies sponsor that or work on. But this is a public-private industry problem to solve, and we will continue to work on that. Some of the things you're going to see for current investments in the short term, this is the reminder of the ask for this year for those of you as you look at the budget. We have some strategic directions, one of them being loan repayment. There's the bill last year that got to the very end, didn't quite make it, but I think it did a lot of educating about the problem and the need in the health industry. But loan repayment is not a strategy that's isolated to just health. A lot of the other fields, the engineers and others, also are wanting to use loan repayment. Trying to get people out of professional programs, either up here or from outside, to come to Alaska and work. We're competing with other states that do have loan repayment and are offering these people with high debt loads incentives to come work for them for a few years. And we know that if you go, like a residency program, if you go and you live somewhere for 2 or 3 years, you're much more likely for you and your family to be settled for you to stay there and work in that environment. So loan repayment is a good strategy. We have another bill this year, but there also is an increment that actually got in the governor's amended budget. We had put it in, the trust had put it in the original budget, and it didn't come in, but it did come in last week in the governor's amended budget. The trust puts money into a loan repayment program, and we ran our own for a couple years, and then the state applied for something that's called National Health Services Corps state loan repayment money. And they needed matching funds for that. We agreed to take our money from our program and match theirs because it got us twice as much money, and we all benefited. We're through our first phase of that. We're hoping to be able to get into another phase with the National Health Services Corps. The trust has committed our funds, and we wanted the state also to put in some funds so that we could get twice as much money from the feds. And so we're waiting for that, and you'll see that increment in the governor's amended budget.
Before we go any further, I just want to say two members of our committee had to leave because they serve on finance and they have a meeting at this time.
Thank you. And then we also have another increment this year in the budget for a psychiatric residency program. No secret. That's in the governor's budget under DH.
An increment dollar amounts down there
is $202,000 is the increment for this year.
It's still in the budget, or it's been on the Hall side at this point?
I heard that this morning in a draft budget it was pulled, but it is in the governor's budget. We'll see whether it show up.
Being in the governor's budget,
yeah.
Now it's the House's budget. That's
yes.
I say, did they leave that in? You said it was pulled?
Yes.
Okay.
I hear that the psych residency and several other things they considered new was pulled in the House Finance DHSS subcommittee. We'll wait and see if it's in their final draft.
Oh, it's not
draft.
Final until it
no.
before.
But we.
That's at the final vote, but it's in the process.
It's in the process.
Out of there.
Yes.
And the original amount that was put in there, that you said was put in,
$202,000.
In the supplemental budget.
No, in the regular budget for FY12.
In the supplemental budget.
There's no money in the supplemental because we wouldn't start till FY12.
What she said was revised, didn't you?
You said the revised budget. So
well, I mean that the draft budget from. I'm sorry, the draft budget. Oh, the governor's amended budget.
That's
for loan repayment. Yes, I'm sorry.
All right.
Yes, two different projects. So the psych residency is a program that we've been trying to put forward for studying for a couple years, and the trust and other partners. Industry, we have a consortium of private industry, the VA, and others that are putting money into the program along with state funds that we need to actually run it. So that those are big ones. The others are some programs the university runs. Called AHEX, Alaska Health Education Centers, and they do a lot of education for our health professionals across the state, and so there's funding in the budget for that.
And Jim? Senator, through the chair, if you have any questions, the Area Health Education Centers, I just wanted 2 seconds to chime in on. From the industry perspective, they are incredibly valuable. It's a federally grant-funded program. I think 45 or 44 states across the country have them, if not everybody. There's an industry match, so they are currently in, Jim, have to help me out, but they're headquartered in some of the regional hubs, in Anchorage at Providence, in Fairbanks at Fairbanks Memorial, in Bethel
at YK,
and then
at Search
here in Southeast.
And also Illisavik College in Barrie.
So in the regions where they're housed, they have a threefold mission, but the part we're most critically oriented to is the outreach. Their primary function is getting young people into health careers. So they manage job shadows, internships, externships, of various types of tools that they use. They make thousands of student touches in the course of a year. The industry, what makes this model, the industry is putting up half the money. So the industry is putting up a match for the federal dollars, and the federal dollars, of course, sunset. And that's how these programs go. They're thrust out to start, and then the expectation that we as a state find the opportunity to pick it up. So the private sector match is there, and I let others speak to the details, but I just wanted to comment on that because it's a very, very good tool, and private sector is behind it financially and, you know, supporting principle.
Can you tell me when that money is due to expire from the federal?
I'm going to allow Jan to speak to that.
Right. Two of the centers, YKHC and Fairbanks Memorial, will get a smaller increment starting next year, Providence the following year, and Search 2 years after that. So it's a six-year time frame that they do full funding, then it starts sliding off. And those two are vulnerable. It, the center allocation goes from about $250,000 down to $100,000 of federal funds.
Okay, I think that I hope that you'll get a chance to look at the plan. You'll be hearing back from the coalition in the next year over strategies and places we want to go in the future. And you'll hopefully hear more about, from all of our partners, some of the things that, that they're doing and that we need to continue to do. So we appreciate your time today and hope that you've gleaned a little new information about healthcare workforce needs in our community and how it contributes to jobs and the economy. Thank you.
You know, we're very pleased to hear about the work that you're doing, but let's go back and you said you took this plan before. Was that the mental health board itself that approved the plan? Who is it that you took this plan to?
This,
it's the Alaska Workforce Investment Board that looks at industry plans and approves them for the state.
And that is state run?
With the Department of Labor. Jim is the chair of the AWIP.
It's staffed from the Department of Labor. It is actually the governor's Workforce Investment Board. The staff is housed in labor because that's the closest association. But to your point, Senator, the plan has also, I'm going from memory, I believe that I'm accurate, the plan has also been endorsed by the State Hospital and Nursing Home Association Board of Directors. I don't know, has your board?
Yes, trust.
The trust board. So for our partners that have, the Board of Regents from the University, so for our partners that have active board of directors, we've gone to them. Others are independent, of course, and don't have to have that formal step.
That makes me understand better. Thank you very much. Any questions from the members? If not, we want to take this opportunity to thank you to come forward. I know you went in a short term, but we got this to Hal for us to go back and review it. Might have other questions for you at a later time.
Thank you very much, Senator and committee members. We're at your disposal if you ever need us.
We're going to take an eight at this point and try to get.
Hair Ombudsman for the State of Alaska. And I'm very grateful, committee members, for your time today. My goal is to help you become aware of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman program in our state. And I think this is an opportune time because long-term care is sort of considered our elephant in the living room in the healthcare system. We have a lot of aging baby boomers coming forward who will need this type of care, and I would be one of them. So my goal today is to explain our authority for doing what we do to preserve and protect the dignity of seniors age 60 and above in long-term care, to talk a little bit about the agencies that we coordinate with, the people we serve, and the outcomes that we're getting, and there'll be a little tiny ask at the end in regards to our FY12 budget. So I'm on this page that says authority. So before I start, I would just like to say two words about why I do this work. I will say that my own parents were in long-term care in the state of Washington until this last year when they both died. My mother received good care. My father received appallingly bad care at very great cost. The providers who were taking care of him told me a lot of stories on the phone. And when I went down and they knew I was coming, they cleaned everything up. But it wasn't until I made an unannounced visit that I found I had to move him into a better facility. At that time, I thought to myself, if I can prevent this from happening to somebody else's parent, I really want to do that. And so I've gotten this opportunity, and I'm just really thrilled. I have been the long-term care ombudsman only since August, so I'm relatively new in the position. So let me talk first about the authority of the long-term care ombudsman to oversee, investigate, and resolve complaints in long-term care for seniors. The Federal Older Americans Act of 1965 originally established, of course, a safety net of services for seniors across the state, including a pilot program for a long-term care ombudsman. And in 1978, the program was established for the entire country. So every state and territory in the nation has a long-term care ombudsman. And the program was originally conceived as sort of a consumer protection program to provide paid staff, but also trained and certified volunteers to keep an eye on what was happening with seniors in the long-term care facilities. Alaska Statute 4762 sets out the specific duties of our position, which is consistent with the Federal Older Americans Act. And the ombudsman is charged with investigating and resolving complaints made by or on behalf of older Alaskans in long-term care. If the complaint relates to a decision, action, or failure to act by a provider or by a public agency or social service agency that may adversely affect the health, safety, welfare, or rights of the older Alaskan. So we have quite broad powers by the statute to respond to complaints from the public, to have access to the facilities and to residents. In fact, it's a Class B misdemeanor to stop us from getting access to a facility. And I will say here that resolution of complaints can involve many strategies. We can sometimes mediate a dispute, help a provider come up with a better way of doing things. Sometimes we can provide long-term care providers with better strategies for dealing with behavioral problems. But sometimes we cannot resolve the problem, and we do have to ask another state agency to take over for us. And I want to say right here, I am very grateful to the Department of Health and Social Services, and particularly to Deputy Commissioner Pat Heffley, for convening a work group this year of all the agencies involved in this process to come up with an interagency protocol. And that's to make sure that as agencies together, Adult Protective Services, Certification and Licensing, Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, and the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, to make sure we are not duplicating services, we're operating efficiently and serving the seniors as we're mandated to do. I do want to make clear, and I'm on ALTCO enforcement authority, that while we have broad powers to investigate and to resolve problems, While we have powers to subpoena witnesses and testify in court and pursue legal or administrative remedies, we don't actually have the authority to shut down a house, to make any licensing actions, or to remove seniors from homes. Licensing actions do come out of DHSS certification and licensing, and Adult Protective Services is responsible for removing people from homes if that is in fact necessary.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings.
Greetings.
What should we do to make that optimal? Should you have authority?
Through the chair to Senator Dyson, no. I think that we have the right people in the right place already. We could probably use more of them because the complaints to Adult Protective Services and licensing are going up, and the system's pretty stretched. But our role is really resolution of complaints and monitoring of the system as opposed to enforcement.
All right. So when you observe something that's not right and are not able to resolve it with the provider, and you report it to some of the agencies, do you get doing what is necessarily rapidly enough to protect the seniors?
Yes, I would say yes, and especially since Deputy Commissioner Heffley worked on that interagency protocol, it's really improved over time, and I think the operations are pretty smooth given how many agencies are involved.
Yeah. So. And just last thing, if I may, I'm pretty interested in fraud, and so if you get a chance either here or afterwards, I'd be appreciate knowing what you know about fraud by providers.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you.
Through the information that you're going to give, you're not just going to give it to that one person, you're going to give it to me to distribute to the committee itself.
Whatever the questions are.
We don't have time to really go into the details of it, but there's information that you give it. We do have a task force that's dealing with that area, and so that information for Medicaid task force might be helpful information to them. I didn't realize that you had search information, but apparently you do, because you said, yeah, I'll give it to you. So I'm kind of interested in finding out exactly the extent of that. It doesn't have to be doing the report. You'd be given that all your time.
Right. I will just add here, Madam Chair, that the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit does have powers to prosecute fraud offenders and is currently engaged in prosecuting a provider right now on three counts of neglect of a vulnerable adult. So they have pretty broad powers to prosecute not only Medicaid fraud but also abuse and neglect on the part of providers. But I can help get some more information from the department for this committee.
Since we do have that break at this point with that question, maybe I could also ask, how many people do you have? Are you there by yourself and just volunteers, or do you have other paid staff?
I have five staff altogether, including me, to serve 312 facilities across the state. We have 12 volunteers placed in 23 facilities. So it's a fairly, I would say, minimal staff to cover the area and the mission that we are given. So we're pretty stretched, but it's
are
a small staff.
Are you able to cover all those areas now with the present staff?
Well, the piece we have to do, because the law says we have to do, is investigate and resolve complaints. What tends to be harder to do is to provide the facility monitoring, because we are supposed to monitor each facility every quarter, and we can't get to all those.
Able to do that.
Mm-mm. No.
And you're probably making what, one visit a year?
If we're lucky, yes. We get out as often as we can. If we do an investigation in a remote part of Alaska, we cover all the facilities there, but we don't have the most plush travel budget either. So between having minimal staff and not a lot of money for travel, we use it efficiently and do the best we can but there's a lot to cover.
Did you ask for an increase in your budget?
In the FY12 budget, we have asked for, and it's in the operating budget this year, for the continuation of a one-time increment that the legislature gave us last year so that we have two fully funded investigator positions. So we're not asking for a new PCN, just for the continuation of the two investigator positions.
And as far as you know, it's still in the budget?
As far as I know, I haven't heard that it's disappeared. I'm praying. I just want to say briefly that the Older Americans Act has a little broader mandate for our office than just investigation and resolution of complaints. It does. Is this not working very well?
Oh, it's working. I thought it was supposed to sit up higher so we could see it from there and not have to look back there.
So. Okay.
Okay, there you go.
So beyond investigating and resolving complaints, as I mentioned, we are intended to monitor conditions in facilities. That's our federal mandate, to advocate for vulnerable seniors and to raise public awareness about elder justice issues. So we have pretty broad powers to really work to represent vulnerable elders. And just in case this is a question, we are administratively housed in the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. They manage our budget, pay our bills, give us general HR and IT support. But we are represented by the state attorney general, and our attorney general also ensures that we are operating within the mandates of the law and no further. Our funding is a combination of federal Older American Act money that comes through the Division of Senior and Disability Services and some matching state GF. I mentioned that we had five staff, 312 facilities to cover. We have not only investigations but monitoring visits. We also provide consultation with the public, training for providers, and managing that volunteer ombudsman corps. I want to say a quick word about how busy we are at the Ombudsman's Office. In FY 2009, we were opening up 14 cases a month, and in the first 7 months of this year, we were opening up 30 cases a month. And I'm not sure if that's because the first wave of baby boomers are out there and we just have a lot more seniors, or if there are problems that we're not aware of. I will say Adult Protective Services is also experiencing an increase in their caseload.
I have a question. Why is it, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, why is it almost doubled since last year?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I'm not sure I can account for it. I will tell you they're not spurious complaints. They're real complaints and real problems. It could be because we've had more media attention in the last year that the public is more aware of us and knows where to report, because the reports are certainly coming in. But I'm a little hard put to say definitively why that is happening.
Thank you.
Let me say something about the complaints we receive. 90% of them are about assisted living homes, and the top three complaints are poor medication management practices, falls or improper handling of residents, and a shortage of staff, which is, I think, an ongoing and critical problem. Some of the people we have living in assisted living facilities are very ill and really need a lot of assistance with their daily activities, and it's difficult for the providers sometimes to have adequate staff.
For me, and I would expect when you said shortage of staff, you also could be meaning shortage of trained or competent staff.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, all of the above.
Yeah.
The requirements for training of staff are very minimal. They have to be able to speak enough English to make a report to 911 and be understood, and they have to be supervised for, I think, about 3 days. But it's really only the only education requirements are for administrators, not caregivers. So that is something that sometimes leads us to have staff that aren't terribly qualified. Very quickly, the resolution of complaints, about 67% of the complaints we receive, and we should not understand that as 465 different elders. We may get five complaints about one senior. There were actually 211 seniors whose cases we opened. But of the complaints, 67% of them we could fully or partially resolve. 23% had to be referred to another agency for resolution. Only 1% were not resolved to the satisfaction of the resident or complainant. So you can see from that how important those other agencies are, Adult Protective Services and licensing. They make up most of the 23% of the referrals that we do make. We are, since I took over the Ombudsman's office, I have gradually come to the conclusion that we really need to be contributing more to improving the system of care and in a collaborative way. In the past, I would say our relationship has been somewhat adversarial with the providers. I don't think that's necessary. Nobody benefits if a home closes. It's very disruptive to seniors. So we have increased our volunteer ombudsman corps, which means that we provide very well-trained, supervised, certified ombudsmen. We place them in homes where they can visit once or twice a month. And the purpose of this is to catch problems and resolve them before a senior is hurt or somebody loses their license. And it's not as if the volunteers are not finding problems. They're finding all kinds of things. They go into a home and find seniors sitting in mittens and hats and coats because it's too cold. Hot dogs five times a week. Somebody whose briefs are not being changed quickly enough. You know, problems that we want to have taken care of. I will say that we've worked very hard with the providers to get them used to the idea of volunteer ombudsmen. They're not always enthusiastic about the visits from volunteers who are trained to be courteous and respectful and to work with administrators. We're not trying to be subversive. I think that our system of care for assisted living is just getting used to the idea that the entire healthcare industry is under intense scrutiny to make sure that public money is being spent appropriately. And when it comes to scrutiny and monitoring, they actually aren't receiving any more than anybody else and possibly less. That would be just my opinion. I'm hoping that we will have as many as 50 volunteers by the end of the year. I really see improvements in the homes where they're placed. I think that's our best opportunity to prevent problems, and really none of the other state agencies have that opportunity to manage a volunteer corps. It's also a very efficient use of state money. And there's one of our volunteers with a lovely lady in one of our facilities. I mentioned the collaboration. We've really been working with DHSS to try to collaborate better. We're participating in their licensing orientations for new administrators. We asked for more time to speak with the new administrators, and we were granted that, so that we can talk about the problems we're seeing and how to prevent them. I very much appreciate that Division of Senior and Disabilities Services has included us in their mortality review team, because it gives us the opportunity to review deaths and go back and investigate if something does not look right. So again, FY 2012 budget, you will find us in the governor's operating budget and the mental health bill. So far as I know, those are still in there, and it's not a new PCN. So I hope I galloped along as fast as I could. I'll stop there, and if there are other questions, I'd be very happy to answer them.
This information has been very helpful, and glad to have this in all calls. Are there any other questions from the members present?
Senator Dyson. Yeah. Like when I first got looking at foster program kids, from my perspective, the remuneration was pretty good. And in that area and the assisted living, I have been concerned that it ends up being, for many of the providers, or at least some of them, a fairly comfortable business, home business, if you will. And the two or three that I've been in recently felt more like a warehouse than a comfortable living situation for the seniors. And I hope I was only visiting the bad examples. But is there a better way for us to do this so it isn't such an attractive business opportunity that's negligent about the care of the clients?
Through the chair to Senator Dyson, there are many things we could do, and I think I don't feel competent to tackle the issue of how much Medicaid should pay for or what the reimbursement rates should be. But I will say there are changes we could make. We do need to look at revising our assisted living licensing laws. I know the department has taken that under consideration with the Mental Health Trust Authority because, in my opinion, in this state, the licensing laws are pretty easygoing. We could also do more to provide training for direct caregivers and possibly even incentivize so that providers are really stepping up to the plate and getting the caregivers trained, because that is a part of the problem. I could have a lot more ideas, and I will think about that and forward them to this committee. Yes, to Senator Davis. Thank you.
And if I may just follow up, the new commissioner, Bill Stewart, is quite aware and quite concerned about all this. We can affect the budget. We can change the statutes if that needs to be done. But it's a difficult process for us to change the regulation. There we can use my intimidation or Betty's charm to influence people. But we really need to be told what to do, and you know, just the specific things. And so I'm sure I speak for the rest of the committee when you find things that we can do to make it work better. The chair will be very good at getting it to us and motivating us.
Well, thank you, and through the chair to Senator Dyson, I think this is an opportune time to say it's time in our state to have a long-term care plan, because that's the kind of thing that would really be covered in that sort of plan, and we don't really have one. We've had a lot of research studies, but not really a plan that we can all sign off on that really looks at all aspects of how we're going to provide long-term care in this state.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's been very informative.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Madam Chair, yeah. I don't know but this lady is the one that is responsible for all the child advocacy centers in the state. She is the patron saint of that whole movement.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I have a one-member fan club.
We are legion.
It's good or none, right?
That's true.
Okay, we're going to now have our third presenters to come forward. They got the equipment working, so you won't have any problems. While they're getting things together, I want to remind everybody about Keep Campaign Coalition's dinner tonight.
Centennial Hall.
Centennial Hall, yes. It starts at 6 o'clock. All right, Denise.
So, good afternoon, everyone. Chair Davis. I want to thank you for this opportunity to present findings to you from the Older Alaskan Survey and the Elder Senior Community Forums that the Alaska Commission on Aging conducted this year as part of our efforts to develop an assessment of needs for the Alaska State Plan for Senior Services. My name is Denise Daniello, and I'm the Executive Director for the Commission. So here are the topics that we're going to cover today. We're going to do a quick overview of the demographics of Alaska's senior population, the grain of Alaska, talk a little bit about the purpose of the needs assessment and the methods we use to collect the data.
describe a little bit about the characteristics of our survey respondents, highlight some findings from the senior survey as well as the elder senior community forums, and then present a list of priorities of concerns from seniors as expressed during these community elder senior forums and, as well as the senior survey. So this is our commission with the governor and first lady. The mission, our purpose for the Commission on Aging is to advocate and plan and educate on behalf of all older Alaskans to make sure that they have a meaningful quality of life and have access to the services that they need in order to stay in their homes and communities for as long as possible. We have an 11-member commission. 7 members are appointed by the governor, with 6 members being seniors. The remaining members are designated for the Department of Health and Social Services, the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, for the chair of the Pioneer Home Advisory Board, because we have a very close relationship with the Pioneer Homes, and a senior provider. So we'll talk a little bit about the demographics of the senior population. So it should come as any surprise to anyone here that the senior population is growing rapidly in the state, as well as it is in our nation. Alaska continues to be the state with the fastest growing senior population, which is primarily due to the aging of the baby boomers, people who came to our state back in the 1970s and 80s in order to work, take jobs during the oil boom, and they're still here and hoping, you know, planning to retire. These two charts show how the age profile in Alaska have changed from 1977, when the baby boomers first arrived to Alaska. That's the reason why we see that bulge in the age range of the 20s and 30s and 35. To what it looks like now with those baby boomers aging and moving up the age profile in their 50s and 60s. And 20 years from now, they're going to be at the top in their 70s and 80s as retired Alaskans. So one of the biggest growing segments of the senior population, believe it or not, are people 85 and older. And this segment of the population is projected to grow by 500%. Between 2000 and 2034, and this is the age in where people become more frail, more vulnerable to Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and most in need of healthcare services. The senior population is growing in every region of the state. The fastest growing regions are the South Central, Fairbanks, in Anchorage, but every region of the state has experienced a 20% rate of increase over the last 9 years. Currently, one of the most important consequences of an aging population is the fact that more people are at risk for Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, because your risk for ADRD goes up as a person ages. And currently, we estimate that there are about 6,000 Alaskans with ADRD. In the next 20 years, there could be as many as 17,000 Alaskans with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, based on current prevalence rates and the rate of growth for seniors. And so people with ADRD have much higher health care costs, as much as triple the cost of health care for people without ADRD. So now we're going to talk about the needs assessment and the methods we use to collect the data. The Alaska Commission on Aging is developing the next state plan for senior services, and this is what the current state plan looks like. It's got a picture of the Aurora Borealis on the cover, and this plan expires on June 30th of this year. This plan is important because it meets a requirement by the Older Americans Act through the U.S. Administration on Aging for the state to draw down federal funds to run a variety of home and community-based services in local communities as well as the statewide level. So these funds through the Older Americans Act are matched against or matched with state general funds and state general funds with mental health funds to provide services such as the senior meal program, home delivered meals, congregate lunches served at senior centers, transportation, chore, respite, information referral, and so on. These funds are provided through Title III of the Older Americans Act. We also have funds to provide vocational training for low-income seniors. That's through Title V of the Older Americans Act. There's also funding to provide senior meals or elder meals and transportation supportive services to tribal organizations. That's through Title VI. And there's also funds for elder protection, too, that fund older the Office of Long-Term Care Ombudsman, as well as Adult Protective Services and Legal Assistance, and that's through Title VII of the Older Americans Act. So one of the main components of the state plan is to have a needs assessment, which is the reason why we conducted our efforts this year. And our efforts included the six elder senior community forums, as well as a four-page senior survey, and I believe you have that in your packet, and a provider survey. So the four-page senior survey was available both in paper and electronic formats. We mailed them out to senior centers and other provider agencies. It was also posted on our website, as well as websites of other agencies within the Department of Health and Social Services. The trust carried a link to for the survey, and it was published in the Senior Voice. And we got a large number of responses, 3,222 in total, from people age 50 years and older, of which 2,836 came from people age 60 years and older. So before we talk about the findings from the survey, we want to disclose that this was not a random, statistically valid sample of Alaska seniors. It was a sample of convenience. And so we can't draw any precise conclusions about the status of seniors. However, we did receive a large number of responses that was representative of all regions of the state and ethnicities of seniors, as well as age segments within the senior population. So now we'll take a quick look at the characteristics of the survey respondents. The majority of people responding were seniors age 60 years and older. We received responses from every age group. Oldest person was 107 years old. And so now, as we move the analysis forward, it's just going to focus on seniors, people 60 years and older. Although men and women are pretty much equal in terms of the senior population in their proportions, from our survey, we collected more survey responses from older women. However, the ethnicity tracked well with the general profile of Alaska's population. We received survey responses from every region of the state, with Region 4 giving us the highest number of responses, and that includes the Anchorage area, which is where a lot of seniors live. And we asked seniors to tell us how long they lived in Alaska, and they answered by saying that 56% of them have lived in Alaska for more than 40 years, with 16% of them being born here. Another 28% said that they lived here from 21 to 40 years, and only 8% lived in Alaska 10 years or less. So in other words, the seniors who responded to the survey were longtime Alaskan sourdoughs. They've been here a long time. So now we'll talk a little bit about the findings from the survey. One of our questions we wanted to know is if the seniors are happy living in the community where they're living. And a little bit more than half of the respondents, 53%, said that they would recommend their community as a good place to live to other seniors. Another 42% said that they would, but they had some reservations. And only 6% said that they would not. So that was good news to hear. In another question, we asked seniors to tell us how many times they took part in a social activity in the past week. And the responses were roughly one-third, one-third, one-third of seniors having very limited social engagements of zero to one time during the last 2 weeks to a group that had that was very social and being involved with other people on an average of 2 to 3 occasions during the week. The survey also asked people if they visited their senior center, and 59% said that they visited their senior center at least once a month, which says to us that senior centers are an important place for socializing for seniors as well as receiving services. 12% said that they would like to participate in those senior center activities, but they don't have a way to get to the senior center, and 9% said that they didn't have a senior center in their community. The survey also asked seniors about their monthly income, whether it was enough to make ends meet. 20% of the respondents said that they didn't have enough money to make ends meet. Now, we did a similar survey back in 2005 with similar questions, and we found that back in 2005, about 20% of the seniors back then didn't also responded the same way. And this 20% also tracks well with the percentage of people receiving senior benefits, which is about 19.3%. Based on the survey responses, about another 2 in 5 are living comfortably, but another 2 in 5 are living, they just have enough money to make ends meet. They don't have anything to put in savings in case there was an emergency. We asked seniors about their household income, and more than 50% said that they were making that they had monthly household incomes of $2,000 or less. Now, $2,000 equates to about 176% of the federal poverty guideline, which is at the low level for receiving the maximum monthly benefit from senior benefits.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
That seems incongruous to me. Because Social Security for a couple is more than that for most of us. And so, am I wrong, or what's going on? I've got cognitive dissonance.
I know that too. Through the chair, Senator Dyson. This is a person could be responding for themselves. So if they're responding for themselves and they are a single person, it's not in a couple, $2,000 or less.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right, so
it's not family. Yeah, and then, no, it's not family. It's the person responding. And also, if I may add that sometimes in rural Alaska, people who have lived a subsistence lifestyle, they're not collecting Social Security.
All right. Thank you. Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. So thank you. We also asked seniors if they had any illness or disability that limited the range of activities that they enjoy. And 60% or 3 out of 5 of the respondents said that they did. And listed a physical disability such as vision impairment, hearing problems, knee or hip problems, or a chronic disease condition such as cardiovascular disease or diabetes. However, 2 out of 5 older Alaskans who were surveyed, or 40%, said that they suffer no disability or illness. So that's good news. We asked the seniors about the type of housing that they lived in, and 70% of them said that they lived either in their own home or in the home of a family member, with only 17% saying that they lived in an apartment. We asked seniors if their home was in need of modification, and we learned from them that a little bit more than a third of the seniors said that they did need something, like a ramp or a rail or some insulation to help make their homes feel safer and warmer. In the last few years, we've heard a lot of concern from seniors about not being able to find a primary care doctor. And so we had a question in our survey about that. We also had a question in our survey back in 2005. And in this survey, we've learned that 31% of those surveyed reported having a problem finding a doctor. Back in 2005, 24% reported this problem, so we've seen an increase in the number of people experiencing this. There are reasons related to the fact that the doctor didn't accept Medicare as a form of reimbursement, or that there was a workforce shortage of doctors. So in looking at the Medicare issue more closely by region, we found that it's most likely occur in the Anchorage area, where 1 in 4 seniors reported this barrier to primary care. And it was also reported in 3 other regions, too, Fairbanks, South Central, and the Aleutians. We asked the seniors about their concerns, and we provided them with a list of concerns that were based on the concerns from the 2005 survey. And we found that health care and financial security were at the top of the list of concerns for seniors, which makes a lot of sense. And that's something that we were seeing continue. We also provided a list of senior services to seniors to ask them how often they use them and if they were satisfied or not with those services. About a third of the seniors responding said that they use the services, which tracks well with what we saw, too, in the 2005 survey. And of those who use the services, most of them were very satisfied with them, with adult day programs and home-delivered meals being at the top of the list. Now, this response suggests to us that seniors are using the services only when they need them and that the services are meeting their needs. Finally, we had a section in the survey to ask people for their open-ended comments on a variety of topics, and here's a sample of some of the comments that they provided us. We're still in the process of analyzing the comments. There are over 1,300 comments that were provided, and some of the top common concerns were Medicare and health care concerns, senior housing, transportation, home care, and escalating energy costs. Now next, we'll just talk real quickly about the findings from the Elder Senior Community Forums. And we conducted 6 forums in Alaska, again as part of this needs assessment, in Fairbanks, Kotzebue, Bethel, Juneau, and with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Elders Committee. And at every forum, we presented participants with the same list of questions to talk about on 3 topic areas: healthcare and long-term supports, financial security and housing, and healthy lifestyles and social well-being. People who attended the forums were seniors, elders, family caregivers, providers, and members of the public. And basically the same concerns that were raised through the survey were also identified too in the senior survey. Problems with access to primary health care caused by Medicare and a shortage of doctors. A desire for an increase in long-term support services throughout the whole continuum of care, from home and community-based services through assisted living homes as well as nursing homes. And also, I want to mention that people who attended these forums really emphasized how much they appreciated home and community-based services. They felt like these services really made a difference for them in being able to maintain their independence and health, and family caregivers appreciated those services as well. In the rural areas, we heard that some of these services that were offered in the urban areas were not offered in the rural areas. Like, for example, in Bethel, we were told that services offered through the Older Alaskans Waiver were not provided there. Also, that people would like to have hospice services there so that their elder could come back home and to live out the remaining days with their family members. Also, we heard that rural elders who received income from their native dividend checks, oftentimes that put them right over the limit for qualifying for Medicaid, so they weren't qualifying for those services. So that was a problem, too. Expansion of transportation was something that was definitely emphasized by everyone. It was seen not only as a way to get to your medical appointment, but also as a factor that could lead to social isolation if a person couldn't get out into the community. A lot of the rural participants from the rural forums talked about the need for more assisted living housing, especially in the hub regions. And also that there was interest for more development of senior housing. And something that we heard about in the rural forums was that there seems to be an emerging problem of senior homelessness, where there have been reports of elders squatting in vacant buildings or searching, couch surfing on the couches of their families and friends. So that was something that was reported to us. Also, to have a one-stop shop for information referral services, so people know where to go to find information about services for long-term supports. So based on all this is the list of needs that people came up with in terms of, you know, what they would like to see. And we've talked about a lot of these already. So I just wanted to mention that, you know, one thing that we did hear a lot about from stakeholders was the need for a statewide long-term care plan. This plan needs to be a visionary document, as we've heard from Diana. We've got a lot of reports. In fact, I've got, I think, 19 reports in my office. But we need to have a plan that everybody can embrace, that can help us move forward with developing the type of services that we need to do, not only for seniors, but for everyone who needs long-term supports. We've heard about the importance of workforce for training healthcare providers, but also for training caregivers too, and making sure that they receive, you know, the pay and the benefits in order to keep them working on the job. We've talked about senior housing, community prioritization of a senior-friendly environment is this notion that seniors would like to see better winter maintenance of sidewalks and parking lots so they don't fall on the ice, and to see more public spaces made accessible. Seniors really appreciate all the financial assistance that they get through senior benefits, as well as the state heating assistance program. So with that, I think I'm going to close, and I just want to thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Okay, that completes our presentations for today. And as I said, some of our members had other meetings to go to, and that's why we were not able to stay. But this is valuable information, and we appreciate the fact that you took the time to come before us. Any closing remarks, Senator?
No, it's been very informative, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. I know some of the concerns with the Medicare access have been addressed or are starting to be addressed through some of the neighborhood health clinics and Providence Hospital, and then that Dr. Rainier's got a private one, so hopefully that'll help some. But as I know from my days on the Assembly, the transportation of seniors is an ongoing issue, and it's very difficult, and that is something that we desperately need in Alaska, because you just can't walk in the wintertime to the neighborhood senior center. So we still have a ways to go, Madam Chair.
Thank you. At this time, we're going to adjourn at 3 o'clock.